The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
I just am fires all day, and then at the end of the day, I have to do 4 hours of paperwork. I'm so burnt out. It's actually because you have not built a fire department, and you have not built the feedback loops that give you credit for the fires that didn't happen.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name's Dane Gruneveld, and today I'm joined by Maximus Lee. Maximus is the CEO and founder of Emboldened. And pre-show, we were talking about how he gets to work with lots of companies, particularly startups, to scale people and revenue. So two of the biggest problems most companies have. So I'm excited to dive into that today, Maximus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Dane. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more. You've worked across a lot of different companies and with some cool teams. How did you come to find yourself doing this work?
I would say, yeah, I end up telling two stories a lot of times about how I ended up here. The first story is the story about my grandfather. So I learned a lot of what inspired me about leadership from my grandfather. My grandfather was an orphan. He was born in China. He was dropped off as a baby at a Buddhist monastery in a very, very small, like, rice paddy town. And because of the small town culture, as he was growing up, people just associated him with bad dreams. You must be a thief. You must be a liar. You must be lazy, because why else would you be an orphan? And it was, you know, one day that he just got so fed up with that. He just felt like it was such an unjust thing that he ran away from home, lied about his age, and joined the military. And wow. Over the course of the next 30 years, he taught himself to read, he taught himself math, he taught himself how to dress, he taught himself music and, you know, arts, until he retired as a four-star general in the Chinese army.
Mm.
And the most important thing that my family has always talked about with regards to that wasn't, hey, if you work hard enough, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, because you can't will yourself into learning how to read. Somebody has to teach that to you. A commanding officer has to approve that allocation of time during your, you know, free hours. It was always sort of the idea that when you're in the right environment with people who can see your potential, that's when you really get the opportunity to become what you were always meant to be. And that's a leadership, right? That's how teams and environments and your manager make all the difference, not your raw skills. And then, you know, the second story, I told, how did I get into Google? I spent almost 10 years at Google Ventures as a talent partner and then as an operating partner. You know, how did that happen? And it's really funny. I did my graduate work at UC Berkeley in classical civilizations. Mm-hmm. I interviewed for my first job out of grad school in recruiting at Google. And my manager asked, like, what would you do to hire engineers? And what would you do on LinkedIn to search for things? I was like, I don't know anything about any of that. I know more than anyone would care to know about the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. And the one who was my interviewer, who became my manager, said, good, we're afraid of that at Google. So I will create a job for you to come here and do that. So my first job was a data specialist for people and talent at Google, because Google was definitely afraid that they would scale themselves into mediocrity.
Wow.
And so much of what has happened since then is when you're starting to see these companies going through their rise, how do we scale the people and revenue that will prevent them from scaling themselves to mediocrity?
Wow, that's a cool story. I love your grandfather's story too, like, to get to a four-star general and to do all of that learning. I love the way you frame that as it was all about relational power of, you know, relationship with leaders, relationship with team members, and the hard work. And I think that's so fascinating.
Yeah.
I love the way you explained it as if the people can see your potential, they can help.
Yeah.
Create the space and the conditions for you to go and achieve that.
Absolutely, right? Like, when we talk about teams, when we talk about leadership, it's that. Yeah. Are you seeing the soul of the person beyond the data in their resume, right? And that was the difference between that rice town and, you know, my grandfather's career later in his life.
Yeah. And then you get to do that at Google, which, you know, as you say, like, a company that was going through huge scale at the bleeding edge of where technology was changing how humans behave and interact. That's fascinating. What were some of the early findings as you sort of got into the data and started to say, hey, this is where we do this really well, or this is what we don't want to do that we see others doing. I'd love to hear sort of how that came up.
The book that I absolutely think, you know, people should read is How Google Works by Eric Schmidt and Jonathan Rosenberg. And Eric was actually an advisor at Google Ventures, so I got to actually like sit at his feet and watch him lead. And the two things that I really took away from Eric in that phase was, you know, write North Star statements that allow people to make decisions when you're not in the room. Right. And, you know, that was such a powerful thing that allowed us. We hired 3,000 engineers my first year. Right.
Yeah, so
you now all of a sudden we're in the tens of thousands of employees across 8 different time zones. And, you know, Eric was always the person who says, when in doubt, speed is its own feature, right? When in doubt, you know, put the user first. When in doubt, OpEx should be net zero to revenue. And those things allowed you to make a lot of decisions that gave you a sense of autonomy and agency, and then allowed us to be able to keep moving fast. And you can take that into, you know, one of GV's most famous / infamous investments was Uber, right? We just led the Series B in Uber when it was still valued as a $300 million taxi replacement company, right?
Yeah.
And Travis was really good about saying, I want to create flywheels. One, right? That phase, Uber was going from $10 to $40 million ARR, which is kind of like my sweet spot as a business as well.
Mm-hmm.
Lyft was, you know, head-to-head in competition. They were doing pretty evenly. And what Lyft would do when they were opening new markets was they would file permission slips, right, with the Department of Transportation. So we could always know where Lyft was going because those things are a public record and we could know where they had already filed. And it was also true that if the DOT was already looking at an application, they would very rarely take a number two. So it would be like, we lost that market. And so Travis said, I never want to play anybody's backyard. So we're find me a different way, right? We're not going to play that game. And then we helped to hire a chief strategy officer, David Richter, who invented Surge. And he basically said, I want to see Surge in minutes and seconds, not in seasons or months, which is Lyft was hiring people from hospitality and travel to understand pricing changes. And he was like, I want to see it in seconds.
Wow.
And so we found two day traders from Deloitte in New York, moved them to Phoenix, and that was the first Surge algorithms department.
That's so cool.
And then they figured out that if you're operating a pop-up within a city for an event, you don't need a permit to do it. So we would go into South by Southwest. We would go to Sundance. We would go to like Coachella festivals as a pop-up. And we figured out that if you could hire 60 to 100 drivers and show them a 6X surge, we will never need to petition the city. The drivers will protest to bring us back, and we never had to play in that game.
Very cool.
Right. So like those two phrases, right? You don't play in somebody else's backyard. I don't want to play a head-to-head game with policy and regulators. And I want to see voluntarily in the seconds. Like that allows so many decisions to be made at a city market level.
Yeah.
That completely changed. And Uber went from 6 to 40 markets in 6 months.
That's insane.
80 to 500 people in 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, those are the places. And like, were they just smart people? Were they hiring different kinds of smart people? Yes and no. The leaders gave clarity statements that allowed them to get out of the way, as opposed to having war rooms where everybody is in the same place at the same time, right? Trying to brainstorm and iterate.
It's a great example of North Star statements there, Maximus, because I've often had teams talk about North Star as like, well, why do we exist as a company? And it's very much at the purpose vision level, which can be a little bit sort of abstract, ethereal.
Yeah.
But when it's as tight as what you've just described there, like let's not play in other people's backyards and let's look at surge in seconds, I can totally see how that helps people make decisions.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's just the analogy, right? How do we connect ourselves to the phrase? A mission statement gives you a sense of purpose. But a North Star, right, is what a sailor uses to understand guiding direction, right?
Yes.
So like, how do you make decisions to go in the right path? And I think oftentimes that's also the difference between a strategy statement versus a mission statement. You can't have one without the other, but the let's just work really hard to make the world a better place doesn't help anybody make decisions.
No, no. In fact, it can get in the way.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So let's just stick, if you don't mind, let's just stick with that Uber example for a minute longer. So as a talent partner, and you've led the Series B as Google Ventures, so you're sitting in board meetings or in meeting rooms talking to them about what those North Star statements are and how you therefore scale the talent to support the organizational growth. Have I got that right?
So, I mean, that was super early. That was, like, Uber was probably my first, you know, true portfolio company that I supported. So I was a young person who didn't know anything.
Yeah.
They made the investment decision. It was a hard one, you know, and, you know, they published books and there was even a mini series about this, so I can share. But essentially, Uber was saying, like, I'm not going to pitch anybody. You have to pitch me on why I should let you invest in my company.
Wow.
And the thing that Google promised was we will allow Maps to create a special feature in the direction zone, right? That allowed Uber and no other company to be able to be on Google Maps. So that was sort of like the entry point. And then I went on site to spend, you know, a month to 3 months working with the VP of engineering and the recruiting team to say, how the heck are we going to scale this out, right?
Yeah.
In a way that makes sense, that doesn't make us run out of money. And so that was the part where, and all of that is just, what is the org chart design, right? What is the workflow design? What does that mean from, you know, PL and CFO perspective?
Yeah.
So that allowed me to then be able to, in future years, always go to a CFO to look at the org chart design, the headcount plan, the revenue, and then even be able to then say, I know exactly how you're executing. I know how you're hiring. I know when you're going to run out of money.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I tell the partnership to preempt the next round? So that I could have a lot more investor-oriented conversations, you know, with the partnership, because they're thinking about new deals, and all of a sudden I was the expert on the existing portfolio. And so it's like, oh, that's super fun to be able to have those conversations.
Yeah. And that now starts to tie the dots together for me on what you said at the beginning there, which is about scaling people and revenue.
That's
so
right.
You, it's interesting. HR can sometimes get a really bad rap for being all about the people and not about the business results.
That's right.
And I was at a private equity conference recently, and there was a great gentleman on stage. He was brilliant. David Cohen was his name. And he said, you know, as HR and talent professionals in this world of private equity, we need to be able to speak in their language, not our language. And that is sentences, not paragraphs.
Right.
And numbers, like, you've really got to be across all of that. So it sounds like you were doing that early work.
Yes.
As you built the systems and you were able to start building analytics around all things people and revenue.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's so much pattern matching because, you know, as we know in the venture world, you expect 90% of your companies to fail, especially when you're writing earlier stage checks, which is what we were doing. And so there was a great sense of pride and ambition for us to say, but if I could move that to 20% of our companies make it.
Right.
That directly impacts my compensation. And now I'm not just a borrowed recruiter for the team.
Yeah.
I'm actually thinking about things in terms of, you know, how to actually generate returns and valuation increases from an investor perspective and a board level, the purview. But there was also this thing that I remember so clearly in my data days at Google, where it was really the first time that I had seen how tech companies throw money at hiring. So we have, you know, the top 100 coding competition winners that we would try for 6 months and just harass them until they would come to work at Google, basically.
Yeah.
And they would be 50K sign-on bonuses for somebody who's 25, right?
Wild.
80K sign-on bonuses for somebody who's 25. And we were looking around, it was like, that's more than I make in a year, the sign-on bonus. Like, why would we do that? And I remember there was a senior lead who said, in the ads business, you cannot copyright algorithms, not truly. That's in the brain of an engineer. And the ads business is so competitive, it is worthwhile for us to hoard talent by paying them so that they do not go to their competitor. And that was the thing that as people left Google and didn't know, because that was our trade secret. Of course, we were not talking about that in our branding. Look how nice life is at Google, you know, documents and paper and articles. They would say like, oh yeah, just hire as many good engineers as you can. But if your business is not one where it is more expensive for somebody to go to a competitor than it is to pay them to be here and not do very much,
yeah,
you will overhire and end up having to do layoffs, which is what happened during COVID. That people didn't understand that wasn't an open source piece of insight that got shared. And you know, I'll go to clients now and I'll say, what startup have you ever been at where people had so much free time that you actually create a company-wide, this is what you do with your free time, 20% project. Like, what startup have you ever been at where it was like that?
Yeah.
And I can't think of a single one. It's like, yes. So the question that you should ask is, why is it worthwhile for me to pay people to have free time?
Yes.
Than it is to just let them go into the market. And it, because talent to my competitor will come back, you know.
That's
fascinating.
And
the cost of that loss is more expensive than the $80,000 sign-up.
Yeah.
If you didn't know that, you make talent decisions in the wrong way. You know?
Yeah.
And you forget that, you know, building a company, building a product, and building a business are actually three very different types of skills and three very different kinds of leadership.
Interesting. And when you, so I get the building a product's different from building a business, but how do you differentiate a company and a business in the build?
Yeah. So, you know, and I would say like Stripe is a really good example of this. Amazon is a really good example of this, where they have multiple products. And the products have very, very different cultures and very different ways of doing things and very different monetization, you know, products and strategies. But the culture, the practices, the North Star of the company always feel very clear, right? We are a day one company.
Yeah.
We build things in atomic units and two pizza teams.
Yeah.
We're building an infrastructure that we can later monetize. Right. Because our goal is not to be a book company. Right?
Yes.
Our goal is to be the shopping cart of the internet. Right? And so those are the things that then tie people together. And to a certain extent, everybody understands at the end of the day, retail is a 3% margin business.
Mm-hmm.
So like be really lean, or like your ability to get a decision through is how do you justify this against my 3% margin?
Yeah. Fascinating. Coming back to, that concept at Google of like paying people to not be very busy because you don't want their talents to be in a competitor environment. Like from a business sense, it makes total sense. But from a human sense, I question like, how does that feel? Because are they enjoying, you know, mattering? Does their work mean something to other people around them? Are they being challenged? Like the research that I've seen working with Dr. Andre Martin, who'd actually spent some time there at Google, is that your best performers are generally 400% more productive than the average performer.
Absolutely.
And therefore those best performers, then they're motivated more by challenge than necessarily money. So how do you kind of design the talent landscape so you can still hoard talent if that's a business strategy, but also make sure that you've got your best people being stretched and busy and activated?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that what you see in a place like Google versus a place like LinkedIn or a place like Netflix is the clarity about what is the profile of the person that you are optimizing for. So at Google, we've always been very clear. We optimize for pro-social smart creatives, right? And I'll be honest and say that was a lot of great conviction and, you know, vision on the part of Larry and Sergey, because of course the investors in the early days were saying, why are you spending so much money hiring so many engineers? And they had to fight for that, right? But if your goal is to optimize for smart creatives, then these kinds of programs generate the kind of variety, innovation, creativity, even if it spikes and doesn't go very far, it creates engagement. Right. And it creates appreciation for the people across the room for you. At Google, there was an HR policy which said, it's well known, you can never be more than 150 feet away from a micro kitchen. There is also a secret policy that says that coffee will always be slow. And one of the reasons why coffee is always slow is because if you hire people who are smart creatives and therefore rabid problem solvers, yes, you want them to eavesdrop on as many problems as you can. And I cannot tell you the number of times, right? And engineers complain about this, right? It's like, why open office? It's so distracting, all these things. And, you know, you make some accommodation for it, but it's like, it's always going to be open offices because I want you to eavesdrop on those problems. And yeah, I've been in line waiting for coffee and overheard somebody talking about, oh, I can't hire this person, or somebody's overheard me, I can't build this dashboard. And then like bust into the conversation and just been like, I can help you with that, you know?
Yeah.
And ended up in these, you know, like really rich collaborative like experiments. And that was something that we noticed disappeared, right? When everybody was working home during COVID. But it's because you're optimizing for that.
Yes.
Right? Amazon doesn't optimize for it the same way. Meta doesn't optimize for it the same way. But we knew what we were optimizing for. And so then that worked for us.
Very interesting. So if you go into a team where that is important, certainly it was a big part of my early career. I did all of my learning and, you know, teamwork problem solving through that open floor environment. But you go into a team that's planning to do that today, and it's an early stage startup. How does that allow you to influence the founders, the investors on decisions around office space, for example, versus allowing a remote first culture?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think the nature of the business has a lot to do with it as well. So there's some businesses that are just a lot more friendly to remote. GitLab was also a portfolio company. They create an art and science around distributed work.
Yes.
But it meant that they weren't hiring a lot of new grads, right? Mm-hmm. They were hiring people who predominantly were ICs who knew what they were doing,
yeah,
and weren't trying to optimize for management or even a lot of like, you know, incidental experimentation. So, right, it was like, oh, when do meetings happen? They don't happen on a whiteboard randomly. You create a doc, people yes, write comments on the doc, and when there's enough meat in the comments to generate a meeting, that's when you call a meeting.
Right? Yeah.
And so like those types of things, like, oh, but it's because they're building for IC developers. So
yes,
then it makes total sense that you create the culture and your workflows to reflect the business and the products that you're trying to build. I would say when I go into company, the two things that I, you know, look for first in my diagnostic is one, what is the culture that has formed you? So, you know, I have clients that are, you know, ex-Google, like, I speak your language, you know, say no more. I already know what this is going to be about. You know, I know somebody who comes from Genentech. Right. Yep. Now we have to talk a little bit about, right, are you a default to no culture? Are you a default to yes culture? How do we actually build on that? Or yep, people who are from Palantir who have a very, very strong mission orientation, a very, very strong business orientation. And so in a Palantir-oriented culture, you have to optimize for cross-functional collaboration. They tend to prefer in-person, right? And so then it yep, takes a lot more work to create a distributed workflow.
That's fascinating. So if you're being brought in by a customer, it sounds like you have a diagnostic that allows you to understand where the founders and the leaders are trying to take their product, but you also then know where to find people based on certain behaviors and yes, preferences.
Yeah, yeah, because the value proposition will be very, very different. And yeah, also it will define your management structure and your management culture, right?
Yeah.
So we used to say, if I go into a portfolio company and they ask me, can you do a culture and values exercise for us? And it's, you know, 20 people or 50 people. I don't need to do a roundtable, open like town hall. Just send me every email the CEO has ever written and I will tell you what your culture is.
Wow.
Because it does come from the top down, right? And the person who writes your performance review and the person who convinced you to join the company, leaving yeah, your very cushy, perfectly fine job to go take a risk on this startup.
Yeah.
Like, they are actually the foundation of the culture, right? The question is, are we going to be honest about some of those things? And then what are the unintentional things that we need to make sure that we don't optimize for?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I once had a uncomfortable conversation with the CEO who claimed to own the culture of a company and was challenging a philosophy that I shared about something that he'd done. It was an interesting conversation without going into detail. But at the time, I was frustrated by the thinking that, like, in that CEO's mind, the culture will be what I choose for it to be. And yet I'm hearing you say that there's a lot of truth in that. Like, do you sense, like, is there a weighting, a percentage balance? You know, I have seen some very interesting businesses where surviving a CEO can actually drive a lot of cultural behaviors too.
Yeah. I think the statement that a CEO owns the culture feels like they get credit for the good and the bad stuff.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily true, but the CEO does set the culture because we believe in leadership, right?
Yeah.
And a CEO who is unself-aware does not understand how much people are working around you, and that is the culture.
That is the culture, right? Yeah. So like, whether it's intentional or not.
100%, right? I mean, like, there's so many examples from early Facebook days or where it's like, how do you get a raise at this company? Well, right, if the CEO likes you, or if it's visible to the CEO, you are more likely to get one than somebody else. Oh, great, right? So now there's going to be a lot more politics, right?
Yeah.
And a lot more, like, need to have FaceTime with the CEO to talk about nothing just because that's how I get my raise.
Yes.
Right? And an unself-aware, and I know, I think you've talked about this in different podcasts before, I am a very big believer in self-awareness is the beginning of empathy, which is the beginning of other awareness.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, if you don't know that, right, and you say to me, hey, I feel like we have problems with our culture, can you hire me a chief people officer? My immediate response is going to be, no, you need to get a coach, because what will happen is, right, either chief people will come in and then you will veto and torpedo everything that they're trying to do, right? Or you will force them to be complicit, because the only thing that they can push through are the things that you also agree with.
Which is even worse, because you're like, hey, people, here's your salvation. We've hired you a chief people officer.
That's
and then
it.
You hamstring them.
So I was like, can a CEO ever not own culture? Like, I think that would be a lack of self-awareness, right?
Yeah.
But if you think that you are the direct contributor and not also, it just is equally, you know, possible that people are working around you to create the culture, it's still, right, very much you at the root of it.
I like the way you framed that, Maximus, and that probably going back to the conversation I had with the CEO, I was probably challenging him on, by behaving in this way, you're creating people to work around, which I don't think is productive for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, we all have blind spots, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, that's so human. Of course, nobody is 100% self-aware, but at least am I aware that people are working around me, right? Am I aware that I'm being a bottleneck? Am I aware, we were talking earlier, right, that I have created, right, environments where I need to be indispensable, or I need to be permission, and I'm firefighting as opposed to empowering, right? Because I haven't transitioned my identity from the early stages where I was fighting for survival every day and all hands on deck was everybody doing the same thing. But now I'm scaling people and revenue, and I actually need all hands on deck to mean divide and conquer. And I need us to say no to every more things than we're saying yes to in order to create those flywheels to scale. And I haven't changed my own identity framework to do that. There's a culture that's going to come out of that.
Well, you've just hit a couple of points that I'm super excited for. So one, you talked about firefighting, and I know pre-show we were like, you know, the best thing to do, what you love to do, is help leaders build fire departments and not just be the firefighter.
Totally.
Why don't we dive in there, and then I'll come back to my second question around transitioning identity, which I guess is a good follow-on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of my work with leaders right now, because of AI, because of, you know, war, because of the economy, is how do we navigate turbulence? And I'm just so aware that all the leaders that I'm working with are people who are very, very good ICs. So they're great problem solvers. They're great executors and high achievement personalities, myself included. Mm-hmm. You know, when in doubt, like, find something that I can control, right? And like, try to work on that thing and make it as perfect as possible. And so what they end up doing is they go on hypervigilant mode. They go into every meeting and they're like, what's a problem that I need to be solving? Retention risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Disengagement, right?
Yeah.
Like, so they start to go into meetings where they're acting more like an IC than like a leader. Right. Oh, I have a low performer. Yeah. I got to fix that immediately. Let me go and like solve that problem. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not performing and I'm not going to get backfill for the layoffs that are coming up. Let me solve that problem. And what ends up happening is the mindset of that puts you in firefighting mode, like it ends up being a double whammy. One, you're no longer doing your job as a manager.
Yeah.
You're not empowering people anymore. And you're starting to think about your team in a resentful way because now they're just problems that you have to solve.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And then two, you've actually taken a lot of agency and choice and empowerment away from yourself because now everything is on you. You have to be perfect to solve all the things. Otherwise, the team falls apart. So it was like, oh, I have to solve this low performer problem. I have to solve it, right?
Yeah.
I have to solve this team production problem. I have to solve it. And if I don't solve it, it's going to look bad or I'm going to get fired. And it's just, right, like all of those things bleed out in your team in a very specific way, but it also makes you feel very, very trapped. And the burnout that comes from that, right, when they say, yeah, like, you know, I just in fires all day. And then at the end of the day, I have to do four hours of paperwork. I'm so burnt out. It's actually because you have not built a fire department and you have not built the feedback loops that give you credit for the fires that didn't happen.
Yes.
And that's a really dangerous place to be. Especially for people that I could see how much they do it from a place of service and how much they do it from a place of care. And it's creating all of the wrong outcomes.
Oh, yeah. I've entirely been guilty at many stages of my career from going into full firefighter mode.
100%.
And like you said earlier, sometimes that actually makes you feel better because you're like, well, work's supposed to be hard, isn't it? And I'm meant to help people and I'm meant to reduce the stress in their day, but it's not sustainable.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And like I said, I think that actually keeps you from doing the job that you actually are empowered to do as a leader. So for example, I have somebody who was saying, you know, we were a small company. We did layoffs in January. I don't know if we're going to do layoffs again in July. I'm trying to help my team as much as possible, make myself look good. I have this employee that's going to go on mat leave. Zero possibility of backfill.
Yeah.
What would you think if I just did the work? Right? What if I just told her I'll fill in for her? Right?
Yeah.
And it was like, that's so generous of you. Right? And I totally, it's a fun care. Completely the wrong thing to do, right?
Yes.
Because you're going to be sucked into these things when actually what you should do is go to the stakeholders of this person, right? Yeah. Refactor the priorities and say, my bandwidth and resourcing is not allowing me to produce all these things.
Yeah.
Let me get ahead of the game, right? Before it's like deadline or failure time and figure out how we can transition or redistribute this work in a different way.
Love it.
But the instinct of the firefighter is like, I'll do it. Like, let me just get it. It's not that hard. I've done that before. I did it 3 years ago. Like, I can do it. I can handle it. And you end up in a completely wrong place.
Totally. Mm. And it can come from other reasons. It can come from reasons of like trying to protect the team, trying to look good. And then sometimes it's just intellectual stimulation. Like, oh, that's a problem I'd like to get into.
That's
fun. Right. I want to build that Lego.
Yeah.
That's cool. So you mentioned coaching. So the second part of my question is this transitioning of identity. And in your experience, is that coaching of the CEO? Is it coaching of, you know, a larger segment of an executive team? Where do you see the role of coaching in helping that transition play out?
Yeah. I mean, people have said this over and over again, but I think until you're in that place, you don't really know what it means to say that, oh, what got us here won't get us there.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
I got promoted into a leadership position because I was a number one IC. Now I'm managing a team. It's a completely different job, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I used to be really, really good at managing a team. Now I manage multiple managers, completely different job, right?
Yeah.
I was the person who built us from zero to one. Now I got to get us from one to a major player in the marketplace. Totally different job, right? And the things that come with it, right? In my coaching work, we talk about mindset, skill set, and tool set. The temptation is to go to tools and skills first and then underestimate how much the mindset actually affects the way that you actually operate as well.
Yes.
And the way that you use the tools and the skills that you have is also different depending on your mindset.
Yeah.
That flip, when I start coaching somebody and they're scaling revenue, it's like, every deal was hard won. to get us to $5 million. You can't lose any deals.
Yeah.
Right. And then to say, how is that going to get you to $40 million? Right. You're going to fight for every single one. You're going to build them all sorts of custom stuff to win that deal.
Yeah.
Right. No. That's a professional services company. That's not a product company. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So then how do I do it? Right. Like, give people rules on when to walk away. All right. But walking away is like, we wouldn't have survived the last phase if we had walked away. Like, exactly.
Yeah.
Got you here, won't get you there. So we're just going to be okay with saying no to a whole bunch of deals. Like, I want you to collect logos in your sleep. I want you to think like the CEO of a company that collects logos in your sleep.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is, I don't, right? Like, how do I get there? Like, we're going to talk through this. We're going to work on this. This is how we're going to do it, right? And in the sense, like, that's building a fire department, right? That's giving yourself credit for the work that you didn't do to win a deal, right?
Yeah.
Because the business is now like fighting for you to like serve them.
Oh, I love that.
That's a different mindset.
I love that. And on mindset, because what you're sharing there as far as saying no to customers, not doing custom work, there are playbooks out there that tell you to do that. And yet leaders don't pick up the playbooks and say, oh, I now know what to do. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
There's this whole knowing doing gap. So it sounds to me that the importance of the coaching conversation is to bring some, trust, some confidence, and some perspective to kind of walking around what most leaders are not going to share openly, which is their fears, their anxieties. So there's the human relationship, again, kind of going back to grandfather's story, is an important part of bringing that potential forward.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, and this is where having, you know, help 500-600 companies at GV was so helpful, because I could always say to somebody, I don't know exactly what's going to be right for your company. I don't want you to pretend to become Google, Uber, Netflix, or anybody else.
Yeah.
But I can tell you exactly what doesn't work. Right? Mm, because I know who the minds are. And like, just don't do these things. And we'll figure out what the Frankenstein, you know, innovation, especially in an AI native, right, ecosystem, is going to look like for your company. But it starts with, right, like, tell them, don't think about your as-is state, right?
Yeah.
Think about the person that you want to grow up to be. And then we'll like, you know, basically like imagine our way into what the implications of that are.
Yeah.
And sometimes what it means is, right, like, I just don't know how we're going to do it. I don't have a North Star statement ready. Like, well, is collecting logos in your sleep enough directional guidance to be able to get your team excited? If so, we start there, right? No, yeah. I don't think that they would know what that means either. And I think it would be really hard for them. Great. So you don't have the right people on your team yet, right?
Yes.
So the self-awareness is the team that got you here is not the team that's going to get you there.
Yep.
Let's do an org design situation, right? Where we talk about what you need to have in that room. What are the voices that you're missing in the room to be able to actually provide the environment to have those conversations?
Yeah, makes total sense. We said pre-show we weren't going to spend much time on AI, but right now AI is starting to pop up in lots and lots of different ways.
Uh-huh.
How are you seeing AI used by leaders, either to help create and cascade the North Star messages or to build more, you know, continuous feedback coaching into organizations? Are you seeing the early stages of that adoption?
Uh-huh.
You know, what's your experience there?
Yeah. And if I go back to, you know, mindset, skill set, tool set, the temptation to go to tools first.
Yeah.
We're seeing that play out exactly that way in AI, which is exactly why MIT could do a research study, right? That then says 91% of the ROI is zero, right?
Yeah.
The investment is billions of dollars, ROI is zero. Because we're doing tools first AI instead of people or human first AI. And the analogy that I make is, you know, when they first started manufacturing the Model T, the automobile, you had salespeople going to farms and saying, hey, like, I've got this car. It's going to replace your horses. You should buy cars.
Yeah.
And the farmers would say, like, how many horses are we talking about? That would be the question, which is why we still use the language of horsepower. It was because salespeople needed to explain how many horses are we talking about.
Yeah.
And that's procurement language, right? That is how I make the sale.
Yeah.
But if you used to have 10 horses that you hitched up to 5 wagons and took your like carrot harvest to 5 different cities, and then you bought a 10 horsepower car, that doesn't replace your five wagons that were going to five different places, especially when there is no urbanization and no gas stations anywhere, right?
100%.
What you end up with is a lot of rotting carrots trying to get from place to place because it's not a direct translation. That's a utilization problem that procurement is not responsible for solving.
Yes.
So that's one place where it's like, yeah, like we're making that mistake. You haven't figured out how to translate to utilization, and horsepower is not the right language for utilization. We have to think in terms of routes and not in wagons.
Yes.
And horsepower isn't even in that conversation, right?
No, it's not.
So we're making that transition now where, like, what is the human first utilization that we actually need to design as a system level so that you don't end up generating rotten carrots because of what procurement has been able to establish.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the kind of stuff where, all right, how are leaders actually auditing their systems, their judgment, right, to be able to understand the power of AI becomes a really key, like, metric that I look for. The companies that are saying, we should use AI. Let me give everybody $100 every month to build their own agents.
Yeah.
End up with agents that actually don't do that much more.
Correct.
Than the employees.
They're replicating what was broken.
Or,
yeah.
You're an analyst. You used to write, 10 reports a week as one of my top performers. Let me give you some tokens. You can write 100 reports a week. As a manager, now I have to come up with 100 business significant topics for you to analyze that I cannot read in the amount of time, and it has generated rotten carrots. Right?
Yeah, oh, I see it, the AI slop.
Totally, right? What you need to do is to say, like, not like, why do we have analysts? Let's fire them so that I just like, hey, right? What does it mean for us to be able to say, anytime I have an interesting business insight question, you can pull the insights, and generate a one-pager for me to be able to make decisions, right? Like, what is the place of human judgment versus, like, human production?
Yeah.
Because production can be solved with tools, but judgment is a human-specific issue.
That's the mindset.
Right? There's this great example from IKEA where they had bots that were now sophisticated enough to answer customer service questions. So they had 8,000 extra, employees of talent who knew the catalog really well and understood how people were not getting uses, right? Like appropriate and inappropriate use cases from the products that IKEA sold. And they thought, you know what we could do is we can open an interior design division for the company, repurpose them to do interior design, which is about the emotions and the judgment of taste, right?
Love it. Love it.
And they were able to generate like $12 billion from this new interior design business instead of laying off 8,000 customer service agents.
It's brilliant. Right? Yeah.
Like those are the types of things, like what is the design, right, thing? And then how do you actually put the humans first into that becomes, where I think, what does it mean to not be left behind?
Yeah.
It's easy to solve the customer service problem. It's harder to solve the human problem.
Absolutely, it is.
Yeah.
No, that's super cool. Well, we've covered some great ground today, Maximus. I think what I loved from those early stories that you shared was that one statement. You were like, I'm not going to allow Google to fall into mediocrity like the way that the Roman Empire did. And everything that I've heard today, so many great points around North Star clarity statements, like what we talked about at Uber, about knowing what you're focusing on for your talent as you build the business, and therefore how to hire them and build their roles and the way they work, whether it's remote or in office, the way meetings happen. Okay. So much of that is around just the awareness of the human first, as you say, like what is the human's role in this before we lay in any other details around what we're going to do as a business or where our tools are. And that's really encouraging, I think, particularly at this time when there's just so much hype, fear, anxiety around AI that, those things aren't going to go away, and human judgment, human style and taste continue to be super powerful drivers.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really fun place to be alive, right? Like, genuinely within our lifetime, we're going to see so much interesting innovation, not just because of AI, but because of medical practices that are happening. And the difference between the companies that really get to surf that versus the companies who get to drown in that, versus the companies who, you know, get towed by a raft and acquired in different ways. It comes to, right, like, one, are you firefighting all the time or are you building a fire department? And I think that like, probably my big tip for leaders who may be asking that question is do an audit of the last, you know, 5 to 10 fire drills that you were personally involved with.
Yeah.
And then, like, notice what you canceled in order to do that firefighting work.
Yeah.
Because what often happens is like, oh, I canceled my one-on-ones with my highest performers. Yep. Right. You are making a trade-off.
Yeah. Or
instead of empowering your highest performers, you're saying, they're fine. They're not a problem that I need to solve. I'm going to redirect my time to, like, this person who's really struggling.
Yeah.
That's the wrong trade-off, right? You're not empowering anybody when you
do. Or I'm canceling my time going for the morning walk with the dog and keeping
100%,
healthy.
100%, right?
Yeah.
And then I think the second thing is, right, on a very basic level, is the statements that you have, if you want to call them guiding principles, if you want to call them strategy statements or mission statements, actually allowing people to make decisions when you're not in the room.
Yeah. Right?
Because at its very center, human first leadership is about giving people the agency to make their own choices without you in the room.
Yeah.
Right? And that is, you know, also the shorthand of when people complain, like, why is it that, like, my employees just can't act like grownups? Well,
yeah.
It's because grownups make decisions without you, and you haven't actually provided enough clarity, right, or guidance for them to actually be able to do that.
Yes.
And so then they don't act like grownups. They've not been given permission to, right?
Correct.
The culture has actually gotten in the way of that developmental cycle.
Oh, I love that. So what did you cancel to do the firefighting, and where are your statements and principles that make it easier for the team members to make decisions, be grown-ups, feel like they matter and they're doing their best work?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, if you do those audits and you're like, I'm not where I want to be, right? Consider that the beginning of your journey of self-awareness, right?
Yes.
And if you want to, you know, talk to a coach, it doesn't have to be me. I think it's helpful to have somebody that does not report to you and is not going to affect your reputation in any kind of, like, right or wrong way.
Yeah, with the board or otherwise. Yeah.
As you're figuring out some of these, you know, self-awareness cues, because to release that, right, to release the thing that made me successful and how I got here,
mm-hmm.
like, that's sometimes difficult work. All the reward mechanisms were on the one side, right?
Yeah.
That's how I got promoted in the first place. And you're just telling me, you're like, we wouldn't have made it to this round if we didn't try to close every single deal. You're telling me I should just walk away from deals and that's going to make me more successful? Are you crazy? Right?
It's hard.
There's no way.
Particularly if it's a founder that's been in every sales call for the first 50 deals and now you're telling them don't go on sales calls. That's a huge shift in their, not only identity, but just the structure of how they run their day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you start to think, like, that feels like it's too easy. Just collecting logos in my sleep, right? Like, that feels too easy. That can't be how it works. It's like, it's not that easy.
Yeah.
And two, the goal is to be easy, right? Firefighting leaves destruction in its wake. Fire departments don't have to do that.
Yeah, we can go around and teach people how to, not leave the EV charging or the electric bike charging overnight in the garage or the other fire risks.
That's right. All right.
Yeah.
It's a good day if you don't smell like smoke, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome, Maximus. For any of our listeners that want to reach out, contact you, learn more from your sort of wisdom and experience with helping these startups really be human first in their journey to scale people and revenue, how do they find you?
LinkedIn, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I also decided that, I would make, 60-minute strategy sessions available for free for people on the podcast who just want a second pair of eyes on some of the things that they're doing. So I'll send that Calendly link
awesome.
For you to put in.
I might take you up on one of those for one of my new projects.
Yeah. It's a fun time. It's a really fun time, but the burden on leadership has not been as great,
it's heavy.
As it is right now. So I've just tremendously, honored to work with the people and to spend time with this community.
It's awesome. Well, thanks for all the work you're doing, and I'm excited to follow up and have a 60-minute session soon.
On to it. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Maximus.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.